This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington tenant Brad May waited 13 days for a property manager to fix a broken sewage pipe.
Because we are lower-income people living in lower-income housing, these property managers assume that everyone in that position doesn't have the resources to be able to stand up for themselves and advocate for themselves.
Find out why the city couldn't help in part two of the series Landlord v. Tenant with GLT's Julie Valente. Plus, the Immigration Project reacts to President Trump's announcement that he'll end DACA. And members of the Downtown Commission talk about a catalyst project for downtown Bloomington. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Downtown Bloomington Task Force has launched a community discussion about the Bloomington Public Library, Connect Transit, and the Market Street Parking Garage. The task force spent its meeting time on Tuesday discussing locations for a catalyst project that could spur future development. In the studio are Ward Ford Alderman and Task Force Chair Amelia Burgess and Task Force Member and Bloomington Planning Commission Chair Justin Boyd. Thanks to both of you for your time on Sound Ideas. What does a catalyst project mean to you? Justin, let's start with you.
A catalyst project is something we can count on as an immediate
success. All right, we're having some technical difficulties. Let's go with Amelia. And Justin, why don't you come on into the other studio? Bring your headphones.
Thank you. A catalyst project is a larger scale project that would have a meaningful and larger impact on the downtown area. And we're not just discussing catalyst projects. We're also looking at those smaller, easy to achieve activities that we can conduct in the downtown area to improve those facilities in the short term. But we're also looking at a more holistic approach to development of the downtown area and continued revitalization, with the understanding that a catalyst project alone is not enough to have a fully revitalized downtown area. The same as these smaller to achieve projects are not alone, will not achieve the results we're looking to obtain.
Did the task force settle on a singular idea? Is the point of the discussion moving forward a new library and transit hub at that location of the current Market Street garage?
Well, that project certainly has captured the imagination, and we're looking at that possibility, and for good reason. As a task force, we are being informed by the existing comprehensive plans that are already in place, that already provide us guidance in this area. And that was one project that they identified, both plans identified, as a potential for catalyzing the downtown area. So because of the concurrent discussion about the need to expand or to significantly renovate our existing library facilities, it makes sense to have this conversation. Can we afford to do both? And if not, can we combine those two projects into one?
Justin, what are your thoughts about, does it have to be at that location? Where else could a catalyst project be?
Well, it certainly doesn't have to. In the past, we've had a lot of talk about the front and center building. Tom Dabermeyer presented to us several areas downtown where there's opportunity.
The community development director.
Right. But this one made the most sense with the less risk, being that the city owns the property, the size of the property, and as Amelia pointed to, being able to combine the library with that to build both a catalyst project and provide a library with a new facility.
How much money is being put into this parking garage by the city to keep it open, and what kind of investment is ahead?
Yes, well, the parking garage itself we know has reached or exceeded the true length of its usable lifespan. A few years ago, the city did put a significant amount, several hundred thousand dollars, into that facility to keep it going. And we will have to be looking at either doing the same in the next 5 years or finding a way to redevelop that property. So this is, in terms of an area that has to be dealt with by the city, this is a higher priority.
So how much money would it take to just replace the parking deck?
That's a good question, and I don't have numbers yet. Right now, we're really at that brainstorming stage. We want to see where the interest lies, and if there is sufficient interest, then we start getting into the feasibility. How much will it cost? How do we bring those pieces together?
What is a meaningful gauge of interest for public discussion? How will you say, okay, we've hit the critical mass, let's proceed with this idea? Justin, let's give you that first, because Amelia, as a member of the City Council, has the final say on it.
That's right. But one of the things I think the task force, their job is to look at past plans. And we have the downtown strategy. We have the comprehensive plan that already have hundreds of Bloomington residents, thousands of touches involved with it. And both of those documents showed that this is a possibility. So on the task force, we look through those documents and decide which ones can have the largest impact in the shortest amount of time. And so when Tom Davermeyer presented this to us and he showed us the different opportunities downtown as well as the different projects other communities are doing, as said before, this one just made a lot more sense.
Isn't the library, Amelia, your shot at that previous question about critical mass of public opinion?
Sure. And Justin makes an incredibly important point. This is a well-informed direction that we are going in. We're not just pulling this out of nowhere. We're looking at those plans. We're looking at the projects that have been identified. And this particular project has enormous potential. Yesterday we heard that every single day 1,000 people visit our Bloomington Public Library. There is no other potential catalyst project for the downtown area that offers that kind of foot traffic into the downtown area. That's why this is very appealing. As well as, there's really nothing else on the horizon at this point in time. We don't have other proposals before us. We might say we would like to do something, but that would be a matter of trying to create those new opportunities, whereas this is an opportunity that already exists, is already underway, and is already under discussion.
Isn't the library already on a trajectory to remodel and expand in its current location?
Yes, that is correct. The library has been looking at expansion in their current facility, and those plans are relatively significant. Even just expansion versus building new in that site would be a multi-million dollar project. And the focus has really stayed there in that area, I believe, on the belief that it would be the least expensive, most fiscally responsible way to move forward. And up to now, that has been an accurate way of looking at it. However, when we look at the bigger picture, when we look at the other needs within the city, we have to face the reality that if it is important for the city to both have a new, modernized library facility that meets our current needs and capacity, as well as to have a catalyst project in the downtown area, at some point, given our fiscal constraints, we will have to choose between the two. It will be either downtown or the library, or we can ask ourselves, can we create a third option?
Library Board Chair Alex Cardona seems enthusiastic about the opportunity and the possibility of collaborating on such a project, but he is working under a timeline, isn't he? I mean, the current library needs help.
That is correct. And that's one reason we're focusing on this particular parcel of property, because there are so few impediments to moving forward. The city already owns it. It is a single parcel. It's an entire city block. We have the opportunity to partner with other entities such as Connect Transit. And I would like to clarify, because I think there has been some concern by residents and people paying attention to this conversation, an aspect of this potential project would always be additional parking. So I think there was some concern that perhaps we would just remove the parking deck and not add back an additional parking. But according to our initial looks at this parcel, because it is an entire city block, we believe there is sufficient room there for a library parking structure and a Connect Transit transfer station. And that is the direction we are going in.
And I think we also, as a task force, we're also looking at additional ways that parking can be improved downtown. We've talked about slanted parking instead of parallel. We've talked about using some of the newly purchased surface lots from Bloomington that we purchased through Frontier. So we're going to add parking with the library, but there's also going to be alternatives to parking as well.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Downtown Commission Chair Amelia Burgess, who is also an alderman and task force member, and Bloomington Planning Commission Chair Justin Boyd. We should point out that Justin is also a named sponsor of the Sound Ideas show, in the interest of full disclosure. And we should point out that WGLT Program Director Mike McCurdy is also the chair of the Connect Transit Board. Could there be a whiplash issue with aldermen and library board members thinking the library location was already settled in June after the council in a work session gave its sense of the council and aldermen pretty much said, okay, remodeling and expanding in Olive Street. Doesn't this undermine the credibility of the council, the constancy of the council in already having given a clear direction?
Changing directions is always hard, and that certainly is a concern. However, I would hope that we would not miss the opportunity to at least have this conversation.
Yeah, I made the comment at the task force meeting that it's never too late to do the right thing. So when we recognize how many opportunities we can fulfill with this one project, I think it would be irresponsible of us not to at least discuss it further.
This idea is not a new one. In fact, the task force's charge was not to come up with just new ideas, but to examine and prioritize past plans. Talk about other plans that suggested folding the library into downtown and the possible benefits, would you? Justin, you want to take that first?
Well, I mean, brick streets are nice, lighting's nice, but they're not the catalyst for success. We need to have a project that's going to bring people downtown, and then those other kind of aesthetic things will happen afterwards. There are some things we can do, of course, improving safety, improving lighting, those types of things, and we can recommend those to council. But without a catalyst project, people aren't going to be able to want to spend time and walk downtown.
Camila?
Yes, and when we're talking about the different plans that are available to us and that we are using as a resource, there are two main ones. There's the FAR plan, which is the Downtown Strategy Plan, and then there is the Comprehensive Plan, the Bring It On Bloomington 2035 plan. Both of those plans do discuss the library and how we should move forward. The FAR plan specifically identifies library expansion as a catalyst project to be considered in the downtown area. It also mentioned looking at moving the YMCA or perhaps a community college to the area. Of those opportunities, the library is the one that really comes to the top there. And then the comprehensive plan, the Bring It On Bloomington plan, does not specifically identify a parcel, but it does state that when we are looking at library expansion plans, we need to take that into account and look at how we can better support our downtown area and consider moving it into the core.
One of the issues with downtown revitalization is it's a really big place. In fact, there's been some public discussion of whether the city should consider zoned downtowns rather than downtown as an entity, as a complete entity, and whether the city should focus on certain zones as getting priority. With that sort of sensibility, is the current parking deck the right zone for this catalyst project, other than the idea that you're combining parking, library, and transit all together? Is it really the right place to bring in people?
I think that as it sits right now, you can't call the parking garage part of the core of downtown. There's not a lot of action happening around the parking garage that people want to walk through. But with this type of catalyst project being in that location, it will certainly become part of that core, whether that's zoned as part of the core or organically becomes that way because of the types of businesses it will attract around it. It's only a block or so away from the History Museum downtown. So how wonderful would it be for someone to go to the library and then be able to walk a block and visit the History Museum, eat at the restaurant, shop at the retail stores? This is going to bring, as Amelia mentioned earlier, 1,000 people a day downtown that may not be downtown right now. So it is exciting, and I think it will fit within that core of what we're looking for walkability-wise downtown.
Amelia, your thoughts?
Yes, exactly. And as we learned yesterday, yes, the downtown area, the expanded downtown area, is large, and the potential there is enormous. There are 29 acres of developable land within what we consider to be downtown. But in order to have the biggest impact in terms of planning and moving forward, we really need to start in the center and spiral outward. Now, the Market Street Garage, like Justin pointed out, it's only a block from the History Museum. It's only a block from all the shops on Main Street. It is a very short walk, and if we look at this holistically again. So if we did this type of catalyst project in conjunction with those smaller items that we are looking at and to improve walkability, to improve the appeal to move throughout the downtown area, it can be highly successful. And suddenly, I think you will see residents viewing that northwest corner of our core of downtown in a very different way. It'll transform it into a much more productive area.
Let me toss out a devil's advocate question, though. It's only a block, but that block is uphill. You know, you're going to get older people, you're going to get kids not wanting to do that. Are you really going to get the connectivity in that location that you would perhaps get at the front and center location?
I think the biggest, to go back to the front and center location, I think the biggest hurdle we have is that the city doesn't own that property. And when we want to, as a task force, look at the most immediate impact we can make, that doesn't fit that category. I hope that gets developed soon, but it could take years. We don't know. It's through private ownership. So when we look at the most immediate impact that we can control, I think this fits that pie.
Amelia, geography is destiny.
And it's important. I mean, that's a fair point. And we need to be able to talk about these things. Is this the perfect location? No, because no location is perfect. But we're trying to look at those areas within the core that have the fewest impediments to moving forward. However, that does not mean that we are abandoning or giving up or not planning for those other areas of opportunity. And the front and center block continues to be an area of enormous possibility. However, it also is an area that has higher burdens in terms of development. So it might take more time, it may take more effort. But having a catalyst project that is successful in the downtown area that's bringing thousands of people into the area will make it easier in the future to really attract developers and investors who are interested in coming to our downtown area and having that level of confidence that they're going to get a good return on their investment.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The topic is a catalyst project for downtown Bloomington. With us are Amelia Burgess and Justin Boyd. The new part of this idea is bringing Connect Transit on board as a partner. What does that accomplish? Justin?
Well, as we heard yesterday, I think it brings up the most exciting thing is it brings up the opportunity for some grants. Anytime you can get some money to help pay for a local project is exciting. So I think that's the biggest impact, but also it solves a problem they've had and they've talked about for years. The current transfer station in front of on Front Street there in front of the Law and Justice Center, it's not ideal. I mean, I ride by there all the time, and you can see the congestion that it causes. So I think it solves a problem for them, and it also could benefit the city and the taxpayers by getting some federal money involved.
What is the destination for most of the people, though, coming to that transfer center outside the Law and Justice Center? Where are a lot of them within a few block or two of where they're eventually going to end up, assuming that they're not transferring and taking a different route?
And I think you'll still be within a block or two. I mean, from their current transfer station to where we're proposing to move it is only about a 3.5-block radius. So it's not too far. And also, people are coming to the library, too, which a lot of people will take the bus to the library. So it does solve their needs as well.
Amelia, how much does that matter? What does a transfer center as part of a library offer?
Well, we know that about 1,300 people right now currently go through the downtown transfer station on Front Street on a daily basis. I honestly can't tell you what percentage of them that is their ultimate destination and what percentage are just transferring on to a new location. But I do know from talking to Connect Transit that they're very intrigued by this possibility for two reasons. Number one, because they do see a lot of synergy with a library in that downtown area. Number two, it is a better location because of its proximity to the more arterial style streets than what Front Street currently has. Front Street takes them out of that place. It's a smaller area. It's very congested when the buses are there. So this would allow them a much cleaner, better path of travel. Also, it would improve the rider experience because we could do a transfer station that would have interior waiting areas that might have public restrooms. We could add in some of these amenities that the downtown area and specifically transit users just don't have right now.
The idea of the city partnering with a private developer to do something with the front and center property had some fairly pronounced opposition. This would be public investment. And does the opposition then ratchet up a notch even higher because it's a big boodle of taxpayer dollars?
It may very well. But again, we're not looking at spending money we haven't already talked about spending. So the Connect Transit transfer station has been a high priority for that entity for a period of time, and they've been looking for opportunity. We need to do something with the Market Street deck. And that is going to require public funds no matter what. The library, its current facility is outdated and it is underperforming. We need to do something no matter what. And so this is not about bringing a new project into the conversation. It's just discussing if we're going to be spending those funds anyway, assuming that we are, where is the best place to spend them? And can we get the most for our taxpayer dollars by combining projects into a single project instead of trying to find a way to afford multiple projects?
What is a rough gauge of the taxpayer commitment to something like this?
I think at this point in time, it is too early to say. I know the library is putting together some projections on their potential portion of it, because they would be, I think, the largest portion of it. Certainly, once we get into this conversation with more detail, that is a question that will need to be answered.
A completely new library can run $20 to $30 million on its own, depending on the kind of architecture and whether it's going to be a statement building. Are we talking north of that because you're adding the transfer center, because you're adding parking? Could it be a $35, a $50 million project?
Again, it's way much too early to tell, but I can say that by partnering, we maximize our return and we get those synergies by working together into the future. But I'd also like to point out that, yes, while this, if we move forward with this type of project, it is a publicly funded project. Of course, there'll be some private fundraising for the library, which we anticipate will be very successful because the library is so well supported in our community. But that also removes some of the risk. So one of the reasons that we have not yet found the right private public partnership when it comes to like a hotel conference center development is because there is that level of risk, because we have to then be subject to the whims of the private market. We don't know the hotel market. It goes up, it goes down. It is risky. We can move forward on a project right now and believe that there's a high likelihood of a good return on investment. But 5 years from now, when that project is built, the market could be in a different direction. So when we're looking to lower our risk, a library and transfer station are relatively constant needs. We know, again, how many people will use a library. This is not a build it and we hope they'll show up. We know the moment we open those doors, we're bringing families, we're bringing senior citizens, we're bringing millennials in to use that facility.
Justin Boyd, does placing a big public marker, a big thumbprint in a location downtown like this project, create the potential for other private investment?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what a Catalyst project should do. It should help spur other private developers to want to develop around. It shows that the city is willing to invest in their own downtown. If the city's not willing to invest in their downtown, why should a private developer do so? So I think it puts skin in the game, and it's going to help. I mean, we saw from the Chamber of Commerce helped us get, I believe it was 7 comments from business owners that all were in favor of a Catalyst project because they would be more likely to invest downtown with a Catalyst project.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With us are Justin Boyd and Amelia Burgess. Burgess, of course, an alderman, and Boyd, the head of the Planning Commission. Both are also on the Downtown Commission. A reaction on the GLT Facebook page when this story was posted yesterday was to resurrect an East Side library location, with one person basically saying to put the library where the population growth has been. What's your reaction to that?
I would say there we need to return to our comprehensive plans. And the Eastside Library at this point in time is not consistent with those plans. A downtown or core-centered library is.
Should a library follow people or attract people, though? That's a philosophical question that is quite apart from downtown plans.
I think it can do both eventually. I'm not ruling out an East Side library, but at first we got to make sure that the main library is adequate for what it's doing now. And right now we've been hearing from the library board that it's just running out of space. So the first thing we need to do is make sure that they are shored up. In years in the future, maybe a satellite location makes sense. But something that people need to realize is those satellite locations actually cost a significant amount of money to run. So when we're talking about, again, trying to be fiscally responsible and killing a couple birds with one stone, a satellite location at this time doesn't fit that criteria.
Is there another idea that downtown should hold out for, apart from, on top of, or instead of this?
Sure. And I can tell you some of the other potential catalyst projects that could exist. Number one is housing. We heard yesterday that a typical downtown area that's healthy and revitalized should have about 5% of its population in housing. And based on that, we have capacity for growth. Based on that alone, we'd be looking at additional 1,000 units in the downtown area. At least the downtown has the capacity to carry that. Otherwise, it's looking at things like corporate headquarters. Is there a business who would be interested in moving? Hotel and conference center, that continues to be at the top of the list as something that could be great for a revitalized area. But again, there's nothing at this point in time, no proposals, nothing on the horizon in terms of imminent projects in those areas.
When is the task force final report? When does the council's discussion begin?
Council has asked us to issue a final report by the end of this year. I think the task force is eager to get that report finished sooner rather than later, because we understand some of our recommendations will have an impact on the budgeting process. And the more time we give council, and then the more time we give staff to take that into account if council should approve any of those recommendations, the better. So I think we're going to try to accelerate our schedule a little and look at hopefully a report within the next 30 to 60 days.
How long should a public discussion of the report last, and when should you fish or cut bait on a direction forward?
Well, we've already received a lot of public comment, a lot of individuals who've attended the meetings, reached out to us over email. So I feel like that, in addition to the planning documents, which were based on extensive public comment, give us a good feel where things are going. So I think the task force will be ready to move forward in the time frame that we've been given.
Justin, closing thoughts?
No, I think the one thing to take is doing something or not doing something is going to cost the city money. So we got to look at how many problems can we fix with one solution. And I think, as I said yesterday's meeting, this meets a lot of those, checks off a lot of those boxes. So moving forward, I think this is something that needs big discussion. I hope the public will get involved in that discussion and learn about the full story as regarding parking and some of the other aspects that may not have been reported on yesterday.
Justin, Amelia, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Amelia Burgess is a Bloomington alderman representing Ward 4 and the chair of the Downtown Bloomington Task Force. Justin Boyd is a task force member and Bloomington Planning Commission chair. Justin Boyd is also a named sponsor of Sound Ideas as a matter of disclosure. And GLT program director Mike McCurdy is likewise a matter of disclosure, the chair of the Connect Transit Board. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM. And WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A complaint made to the City of Bloomington or Town of Normal about rental housing conditions is no guarantee of a fast fix. Find out what happens when two Bloomington tenants face a health hazard and the landlord takes nearly 2 weeks to get it fixed. That's in part two of the GLT series Landlord v. Tenant. Judy Valente also reports on what city inspectors can and cannot do to help.
On the morning of July 1st, Brad May and his roommate awakened to a situation no one relishes, a stopped-up toilet. The problem soon grows worse. Raw sewage starts oozing up through the toilet, tub, and bathroom sink in his apartment in Bloomington's Lakewood Terrace complex.
That toilet wasn't cooperating and just kept filling with water and overflowing until we had to shut the water off. You know, that just got worse, and we called the landlord within a half hour, and they explained to us because of the holiday weekend that it would be a couple days before they would be able to be out.
2 days later, the complex's property manager, RCS Property Management, sends a local plumber to estimate the cost for repair. The plumber staunches the flow of sewage and says he will return in 2 days to complete the work.
That came and went. They didn't call us or show up.
At this point, May says he began repeatedly calling the RCS management office.
At this point, we were calling daily and not so understanding anymore. Didn't really make a difference. We started talking to them about rent reimbursement of some sort to make up for half of our apartment being unusable and, you know, a pretty unsanitary situation. You know, every time we called, you know, the property manager was in court or otherwise occupied, and there was a whole slew of excuses.
13 days pass. On July 14th, a new set of plumbers finally arrives to fix the source of the problem, a cracked drain pipe. To get at the pipe, workers have to break through concrete flooring as well as a wall between the kitchen and bathroom. They also pull up tile in the bathroom, remove the toilet, and disconnect and move the stove and refrigerator.
So it's 2 weeks without water. We haven't been able to cook. We've been spending a huge amount of money on eating out just because, you know, there's nothing else we can do. It's just been quite a headache, you know, plus we've got, you know, food spoiling here. We have a cat locked in a small bedroom that, you know, that's not very fair to the cat.
May and his roommate, Brittany Hart, are left to disinfect the areas that had been covered with sewage. cockroaches and drain flies begin showing up in the apartment.
Me and my girlfriend on the 14th actually spent together probably 3 hours or so killing these drain flies that were spawning in the sewage and flying around the apartment by the hundreds. And by the hundreds is not an exaggeration. It was, I mean, yeah, we have a trash can full of paper towels from killing them.
I commiserated with him in his frustration.
That's Kyle McShane, the RCS management employee who oversees the Lakewood Terrace complex where May and Hart live.
One of the things that I said to him from the get-go was, I want your apartment fixed as much as you do. I don't want you living in any kind of conditions that you find unsanitary.
McShane blames the delay in getting the work completed on the initial plumbing company he called.
It's frustrating to me as well when I would like to get work done, and I have to continuously try and call different companies to try and just even start repairs in the first place.
McShane says he then worked as fast as he could to get approval from RCS's Chicago office for the second plumber's bid. May and Hart say it wasn't fast enough.
I developed a twitch in my eye because of the stress. I actually went to the doctor for it, and that's what they're telling me the cause probably is. I didn't know if I was having a heart attack or something or what.
We certainly got extremely ill about a week after this whole ordeal started. Just like the amount of stress, it's been really hard on us, you know. I've been just mentally drained.
As their ordeal dragged on, May and Hart say they spoke with the City of Bloomington's Housing Inspections Office.
I did speak with the tenant. He told me that, you know, the condition of that apartment.
Carrie Sneddon is Bloomington's manager for code enforcement.
We did not verify, you know, that particular situation because the sewage problem had been corrected by the time that we got there.
Sneddon's office is responsible for responding to tenants' complaints and inspecting Bloomington's more than 10,000 rental units. Is there some sort of a compliance issue then with that landlord? Is that landlord going to be cited for any type of violation?
Not at this point, because they did get the situation corrected. I mean, and we were brought in the final day. Unfortunately, you know, we had to take it at that point in time. There was not a situation where we could go back on somebody and a he said, she said kind of thing.
But 13 days had passed.
In my opinion, yes, that is way too long. I mean, there's a lot of health concerns when you're dealing with sewage that's not properly capped or taken care of, you know, that kind of thing. You know, 13 days is definitely a long time frame, in my opinion.
May and Hart's case underscores the kinds of difficulties tenants can face. The city says there was little it could do for them because they did not contact inspectors as soon as the sewage problem arose. The case also shows how a dispute can quickly escalate. Before the sewage leak was fixed, an RCS maintenance employee engaged in a war of words with May on social media. The maintenance worker wrote to May on Facebook, quote, "What kind of bull are you pulling? This is not a one-hour job. It takes days. So to blow smoke up people's you-know-whats, saying nothing is happening, is very childish and disrespectful on your part." McShane, the property manager, says his employee was merely expressing frustration. By the time the Facebook exchange took place, he says RCS had offered to let May stay in another unit until the repairs could be completed.
So he had access to the apartment that was right next door to his for showers, for toilets, or anything along the lines of that.
May says he was shocked when he went to use the apartment that was offered.
It's filthy. It's infested with cockroaches. There's oil stains on what appears to be oil stains on the walls and the doors and the cabinets.
The day this GLT reporter visited the apartment, dead roaches littered the kitchen floor. A layer of mold covered the bathroom sink. McShane says May should have contacted him if he was dissatisfied.
If he would have let me know that there were any kind of adverse conditions in the apartment that he's staying in, I would have had my cleaners go over there, clean the apartment for him, at least clean the bathroom or get anything up. If he would have let me know about any kind of pests or anything like that in the apartment, I would have had Orkin over there generally the same day.
But by that time, May says he was too exhausted to deal with the management company. At that point, RCS offered to let May and Hart out of their lease. In the end, the company agreed to prorate the $585 monthly rent to compensate May and Hart for the days they could not use their apartment. May says he would have liked to move out altogether, but he was recently laid off from a job as a waiter. He says it will be difficult for him to put down another security deposit and 1 month's rent for a new place.
Because we are lower-income people living in lower-income housing, these property managers, they assume that everyone in that position doesn't have the resources to be able to stand up for themselves and advocate for themselves.
I just disagree strongly with the premise.
Bloomington's community development director, Tom Daybriner, says tenants do have recourse.
We are interested in high-quality housing and achieving compliance as quickly as possible. I understand the frustration of a tenant who has a problem landlord. We're there to work with them.
In 2015, Bloomington hired an additional housing inspector. In the past year, the city's two inspectors performed about 2,400 inspections. More than half of those inspections required re-inspections, meaning officials found some type of housing code violations.
We are not interested in supporting landlords necessarily. We of course, support the good ones. They never come up as a problem. But our interest is in supplying, is in a supply of quality housing.
Prairie State Legal Services, a legal aid agency, has compiled a renter's handbook. It covers such topics as getting repairs done, dispute and complaint procedures, what to do if a tenant receives an eviction notice, or if a landlord withholds a security deposit. Emily Petrie is an attorney at Prairie State. She says most landlords know their advantages under the law, but many tenants are unaware of their rights or even what's written into their leases.
They are not aware of what their legal rights and options are under their lease. Some tenants have not read their lease or understand fully the agreement they're entering into when they sign their lease.
May, who had the sewage problem, says he learned too late of his rights.
You know, there are tenant laws and things and, you know, basically a bill of rights for tenants that a lot of people aren't familiar with. They're ignorant to the fact that, you know, there are things that can be done about it.
He says he'll be more informed in the future. I'm Judy Valente.
Tomorrow, in Part 3 of Landlord v. Tenant, Judy Valente examines how Bloomington and Normal try to correct housing code violations in rental properties, what are the common code violations, and asks whether the city is cracking down enough on landlords who are chronic offenders.
Despite the phrase, talk is not cheap, the talk you value on public radio costs money. And to help out, we want you to talk to us. Leave us a message at 438-WGLT. Tell us what you like and why you contribute. Tell us why you can't unplug from WGLT.org and make a case to get everyone to contribute. We want it all. And then we'll use all of your comments to get everyone to give during GLT's upcoming fundraising campaign. Take a deep breath. Get ready to talk after the tone and then call 309-438-WGLT.
Support for GLT comes from the Central Illinois Regional Airport at Bloomington Normal, with Allegiant flights to Orlando Sanford and Tampa St. Pete, Florida, along with service by Delta and American. Information at CIRA.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. President Trump's announcement he is eliminating deferred action against undocumented immigrants who came to the U.S. as children has sparked a lot of questions in many communities. Talia Novoa is an immigration paralegal. Charlotte Alvarez is the executive director and staff attorney for the Immigration Project, a statewide organization helping immigrants that is based in Bloomington. Alvarez says a lot of people have been scrambling to find out what it means for various categories of DACA recipients.
Basically, it means that individuals who currently have DACA can keep their DACA until it naturally expires. Each DACA grant for an individual is for a 2-year period. So anyone who has deferred action now and is not renewing it, it's currently valid, it will just expire at the end of that term, but they will lose the ability to renew it and continue with DACA in the future.
So what does the phase out look like? What percentage of DACA recipients are in their last year or last months, in their second year or in their first year? What's the bell curve look like?
So the phase out will affect, first, it affects anyone whose DACA had expired, but they hadn't either been able to renew it, mostly for financial reasons. We talked to a lot of clients who were saving up money to renew their DACA, but hadn't yet done so. So those individuals lose the ability to apply to renew, and they just are now out of status.
When do they?
as of now. So anyone who had DACA expire before this point, before they could, when they saved up enough money, apply for it to be renewed again. Now, as of today, they're done. They have no more legal status or option under the DACA program. Anyone who has a pending renewal application, that will be processed by immigration, and those will still be individually considered and granted. So they will get the work permit for the next 2 years if they're approved. And then we have some people who are applying in the next 6 months. That's the time period that is kind of talked about in the news so far. Anyone whose DACA expires between now and March 5th can apply, but they have to apply before October 5th. And then, it depends on which category people are in, but the announcement terminated the options and really put people at risk who have DACA expired, and it will, over the next 2 years, phase out all DACA applicants until no one has DACA status anymore.
So how many people in that?
There are 800,000 individuals with DACA throughout the country, and approximately 83,000 to 88,000 that are in Illinois.
So in Illinois, how about that 83 to 88,000, and what's going to happen to them? How many of them have expired DACA?
I don't have good numbers on how many people have expired DACA. The program was created in 2012, and each work permit has been good for 2 years. So if someone was applying and getting it renewed on a consistent basis, it depends on how long each of those these applications took. So it's kind of become a little staggered over time. I expect as we look at the population and we see more people coming forward and seeking attorneys, and we can look at the data, we'll get a better sense of how it will affect people.
Dalia Novoa, what are you hearing from people that you're trying to help? What are they saying? How concerned are they?
I've had a lot of DACA recipients call me today. They're very nervous. Someone called me just to see if they could get a job, if they could go to an interview, and I had to let them know, your DACA is still valid until it expires. There's some people I've had to tell, your DACA expires after March 5th, so you will not be able to renew your DACA, and that's very saddening because they just don't understand. And then there's people, that they can renew their DACA, but they're just all very nervous. They don't know what's to come. Some are safe for 2 years, some are safe for 1 year, but they still have this concern of what's going to happen. They want to stay in this country for as long as they can. So, 2 years of security isn't really enough for them.
What are you telling people who are in the middle of the process or who still have a little bit of time left to apply? Are they in danger of going back into the shadows right now, or should they stick through the process?
We're telling anyone who has a pending renewal application or a pending initial application, it will be processed. They will get an answer, and if they meet all the qualifications, it should be approved. Anyone whose DACA expires between now and the deadline of March 5th should immediately talk to an immigration attorney. They can call the Immigration Project, or they can apply on their own, or they can talk to another attorney. But we're telling anyone whose DACA expires up until March 5th to talk to us as soon as possible to weigh the benefits of renewing. One of the issues with the rescission of the DACA program is that 800,000 people put their information and themselves out there to immigration authorities and gave that information voluntarily to the U.S. government based on the promises given by the DACA program. There's been no assurance on what happens to that information once the DACA program is over. So there is some risk that that information could be used against them or could be used against their family. And we're advising anyone who's concerned about those risks to talk to an attorney and really think about the effects before applying or renewing.
According to both the Obama administration and the Trump administration since then, these folks are not going to be high priority targets for deportation, though. On the other hand, we're hearing that deportation of those without criminal records is on the upswing, just mm-hmm. as they happen to be caught up in sweeps or enforcement actions. So what are people to think about their relative level of safety as they go about their lives?
It really puts people in a very insecure limbo status where they've made reliances based on, especially the DACA program. We have clients who have gone to school and gotten bachelor's degrees or advanced degrees, got in nursing degrees, and now are out working in their communities. They're nurses and they're insurance agents and they're any job within our society. They've grown up here and really created their roots here. So once that DACA program ends, they go back to having no legal protection from deportation. They could be put into deportation proceedings. We have seen the administration talk about focusing on people with criminal records, but President Trump has expanded that to people who even have been suspected of committing potentially criminal conduct. So he's really broadening the net and increasing deportations overall. So anyone who loses their DACA status really has an increased risk of being put in proceedings, even if they have no criminal record.
Thalia, people like you and other immigration advocates have been telling potential DACA recipients to trust the process, to go ahead and sign up. How do you feel now that this has become a little more cloudy?
I feel that we have to keep pushing and we have to keep fighting. Sometimes there's bumps in the road, but we have to make sure that it gets better. So right now, this is a downfall. This is something we weren't expecting. And we want to make sure that everyone that receives DACA knows that we are on their side. So I think just making sure that we clarify to the DACA recipient saying we are on your side, we're going to do the best that we can. And for everyone in the community, you know, to do something as small as call the congressman. You know, we have to make sure that we are their voices and we are their advocates, and that we may have not a lot of power, but we have our voices, and that's enough to start, you know, that to start the cycle of getting immigration reform.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Thalia Novoa, a paralegal with the Immigration Project, and Executive Director and Staff Attorney Charlotte Alvarez of the Immigration Project. Thalia, you have relatives who are DACA recipients. How are they doing?
I think my cousins are very nervous. I was the first one born in the United States, so all my older cousins, some of my younger cousins have DACA. It's really hard for me to see them, what they're going through, because we grew up the same way. They came when they were a year old. I grew up with them. And just for them to message me and saying, what do I do now? What's going on? That's really powerful, because, you know, they think that I can take care of them, and, you know, I came into this work because I wanted to protect my family. So things like this make it very difficult for me, because I came into this field to be able to protect them, but I'm their voice, like I said, and I'm going to make sure I can do what I can to help them, and I'm going to make sure that they are okay and safe as best as I can.
Are you getting deflected anger from people who are saying, I blame you, I trusted you, and this trust was not fulfilled by the Trump administration?
No, I don't think so. I think my family knows that I put myself into a situation where I went to college and I made sure that I was going to this field, and they know I'm trying the best I can. They know I'm not the president. They know I'm not a congressman or a senator, but they know that I'm going to fight for them. And I think my DACA clients also know I'm going to fight for them, because I tell them all the time, you know, congratulations, this is the best. I'm going to do whatever I can do. And so do the attorneys at the Immigration Project staff. So we're just going to keep fighting. And if people are angry, you know, it's okay for them to be angry at me, because I understand. You know, I'm never going to fully understand what it is to be a DACA client, but I do understand what it is to see people, you know, get this ripped away from them. You know, I'm around it all the time. I'm never going to get away from it, because I come from a family of immigrants. And so I'm going to do my part, and I hope everyone else does too.
Charlotte Alvarez, the Trump administration is saying that, you know, the reason for this is to set a deadline for Congress to act on the process that the Trump administration felt was being exceeded through President Obama's executive order on this. A number of Republican congressmen are taking similar lines of thought in their public written statements following this announcement. What's your thought about how the legislative game is going to play out?
Well, I think we always knew DACA was not a long-term solution for individuals. It put people in a limbo status, and whenever we had someone who was filing an initial application or renewing, we talked to them about the fact that this was a program created by the president that could be changed by the president or rescinded by the president. So we knew that this wasn't a long-term option, but in a lot of situations, it's the only legal option people have. So we really have, throughout the previous administration and the current administration, advocate for comprehensive immigration reform and a legislative solution to the fact that we have 11 million people here who are caught in the shadows, and a large percent of which cannot benefit from our immigration system because of how our system is set up with long wait times and lack of options for well-meaning people. So I think we're advocating for either the Bridge Act or the Dream Act. There's two different possibilities for how the legislator could solve this. I hope that they take the rescission of DACA as a call, a clarion call from the communities and from the White House, who's even saying that the legislator should act on this issue.
If you were a betting person, do you think that Congress would take up DACA alone and do a small bite of legislation, or are they going to do what multiple administrations over multiple decades have failed to do and tackle the entire immigration reform issue at once because of this deadline?
I don't think they're going to solve comprehensive immigration reform. I think everyone understands we need comprehensive immigration reform, but I don't. No one really seems to agree on which direction and how that should be. It's a complex.
Charlotte Alvarez is the executive director of the Immigration Project in Illinois. Talia Novoa is a paralegal. Alvarez notes the phone number, 309-829-8703, is a way to get in touch with the Immigration Project, and they encourage people to follow the phone system to look for DACA renewal services. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org.